Hello and welcome to Minbar. I'm your host, Ahmed Hanif. In one word, we can describe the modern world as a global village. A global village in the sense that cultures, peoples, religions that just three centuries ago, that were completely separated from each other, outside of any kind of physical contact, now live shoulder to shoulder. This has created a particular problem for the believers in the Abrahamic religion, in the sense that with our point of view on monotheism, we are now forced to consider the views and the practices of people who live under other systems, who live with other religions. So how exclusive is monotheism? And how can we, of a religious background and following a religious tradition, live side by side with each other in one society? One might say the easiest way is to conquer everybody else and force people to adopt your belief. But today, this is something quite unfeasible. So how do we deal with it, with this problem? How do we live together as a harmonious society and at the same time be faithful to our own religious point of view and perspective on the world? To discuss this, we have as our guest today Dr. Kurt Richardson, professor of theology and philosophy at McMaster University and a visiting professor at U of T. Dr. Richardson has had a lot of experience on both sides of the Atlantic. Dr. Richardson, welcome to Minbar.
Thank you, Alfred.
Okay, Dr. Richardson, one of the reactions of people who belong to the Abrahamic traditions, a Muslim, Christian, Jew, is that when they encounter religions like Buddhism or Hinduism, they are quick to dismiss them as polytheisms. And they do this because they see these religions through the eyes of monotheism. Mm-hmm. You know, they ask, where is their one God? Mm-hmm. You know, and if they can't find a one God, you know, then they're easily dismissed mm-hmm. as a polytheism. Is this a correct approach?
Well, you know, all religions are mixed bags, mm-hmm. right? So each religion has undesirable features to it. Now, I think the majority of Abrahamic monotheists are very consciously believing in favor of this one unitary principle for all creation. And historically, we've been very, very sensitive to the distinctiveness of this faith. Now, by the year 2000, we are the majority believers in the world. There is nothing even close to monotheism in terms of a view of God. But it wasn't always that way. Now, ancient polytheists always had two classes of people. People who couldn't read and who were very close to the superstitions of primitive life. And their paternalistic, more sophisticated, educated, literate people, rulers and other kinds of civic leaders, they tended, by the time that Judaism was well known in the Roman Empire, and certainly by the time Christianity became prominent, there was a great awareness that polytheism really wasn't true. But the polytheists who in their hearts became monotheists did not want to change their culture. And so many of the early debates with pagans by Christians, I mentioned to you a moment ago, one of the most famous debates is between Origen of the year about 230 and Celsus, a Roman nobleman and philosopher. And Celsus is shocked that they could agree on monotheism, but that Origen would be so completely iconoclastic. And iconoclasm has been, you know, a subject even to this day, that is sensitive for those who practice what I call imageless monotheism. Mm. So that would be a first answer. When I speak to a Hindu or a Buddhist about popular religion, and we're being very, very honest, I might ask, well, why don't you discourage the idols and encourage everyday people, common people, to believe in the same way that you do? And that is, you know, you get various answers. Suddenly they might become pantheistic. And then we have a divide. Then it is, because pantheism, that God is all being, is not the same as monotheism, where the creator and the creation are fundamentally distinct.
Right.
On the other hand, they might just say, well, I like to have all of these objects around. They make my world feel more holy. It's at that point you see certain cultural differences are going to remain.
Yeah, I'm thinking about two things that the quote-unquote exclusivist monotheist have. You know, one is what and who is God? What is a God?
Yes.
That's one thing.
Yes.
The other thing is, if we acknowledge hierarchy in creation, then under God, we would definitely find powerful beings, more powerful than ourselves, be they human who have transcended, or they may be
angelic.
Other beings that might be angelic. So you have these two questions here.
Yeah.
All right. And then you have now the third thing, the question of worship. What is worship? Now, okay, these three things. One, we have God, and the monotheist says, the exclusive monotheist says, God is has these certain attributes, you know, that all powerful.
Yes.
You know, all knowing. By definition, if there are any other than Him, it means that He is limited, and because He's unlimited, therefore He is one.
Yes. Right. Or, if He is not limited, they don't have, no other creature is, no other divine being is all-powerful,
right,
and is not worthy of worship.
Right.
And so it comes down, I would much rather see a debate between a pluralist monotheist and, what should we call them? A exclusive monotheists, but with a very active mediation. Lots of mediation going on with angels and saints.
Right.
Because respect at least is being given to the angels and the saints.
Right.
There's no doubt about
yes.
that. And those distinctions between these two groups would be very interesting.
Right.
If the polytheist, when the polytheist says something pantheist, well, then we're not on the monotheist map anymore. If they say something in terms of the necessity of some divine being, some other divine being, that's what would make them a true partner and fully idolatrous,
right,
fully polytheistic.
Yeah.
So to me, the fact that they made this distinction, you see, it's just on the way. It creates on the way to what I would like to think is on the way toward a purer monotheism.
Right.
So when, you know, so
it sort of brings us on the same page.
It brings us on the same page. It's the kind of generosity. It doesn't sacrifice doctrine, but it recognizes that human beings are learning. Human beings are correcting their errors. Because I think the confusion between creator and creature is the supreme confusion, the supreme error. Let me give you an example. When the ancient Jews, Christians, and Muslims debated with The pagan philosophers, they had a completely different problem. There, and this is quite interesting, remember, the fundamental distinction is creator and creature. With the philosophers believed because God is eternal, unchanging, the creation must be eternal too. Because if God made the creation out of nothing, if there was a beginning to creation, that would mean, and God is the creator, that would mean that God changed. And this becomes, yes, this becomes a major, this becomes the most, there are then two fundamentals.
That's creating an identity between the creator and the created, wouldn't it be?
Not necessarily. The philosophers wouldn't do that. But this became the ancient debate on the eternity of the world. Mm-hmm. And they had what they felt were very good reasons. So there are really two great supreme distinctions. There's nothing else like them. Creator-creature and time and eternity.
Couldn't it be a matter of perspective? Why I say this, for example, is because you find in Islam, normal Muslims, ordinary Muslims, going to the tomb of saints and asking for intercession.
Intercession.
And you would find certain extreme exclusivists among them criticizing that and saying, this is a form of worship.
This is
and
why.
And these people are, you'd be treating them as...
This is God. Why I raised this subject.
Yeah. All right. Now, in the Islamic point of view, you have like two groups. Could this occur, both of these forces occur within the individual? For example, the Hindu who seeks the intercession of these powerful created beings, he sees it as worship, when in fact it might not be. The exclusive one could say that, you know.
All of us. All of us monotheists, mm-hmm. I mean, we would condemn that. Mm-hmm. We would say that has gone beyond what this, the kind of activity of any creature does not merit the kind of honor that worship implies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we would say that when we pray for an angel or a saint to intercede, they are either not performing the action directly, they are somehow, as they were, especially a saint when he was alive, if he performed a miracle, he would say, if he was a true monotheist, God performed the miracle, but God answered my prayer, for instance. God gave me this power.
Right.
So is the deity actually saying that the power is not originating with her or him, but with Brahma, mm-hmm. the supreme deity? And none of their theologies say this, that somehow there has been an expansion of the deity. They are creatures, but they now embody full creative power. It may not be as great as the supreme. So those kinds of problems enter in.
Right.
And we can then, if we are the very, very strict type of monotheist, we are imageless, and let's say we are saintless. although I don't think there's anyone who is truly saintless. And no, or angel-less, but we don't call on them.
Yes.
And God might send an angel in a very rare situation. You know, so you know where I'm going with
right.
this. Most of the time, the prohibition of intercession, prayers requesting the intercession of a saint or an angel, is legalistic. It is saying because it is too dangerously close to the any kind of polytheist, mm-hmm. we are going to condemn it absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this is another reason why I hoped we could talk about this, because we do want to know why is the judgment being made.
Right.
Is it being made because there is true error here, or because we are fearing that it's dangerously close to true error?
I think it might be the second.
I think it is the second.
Yeah, because I mean, people could confuse the effect with the cause.
Absolutely.
And pay focus on the effect.
Absolutely.
Now, if we look at Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, all three religions have saints. All three religions have their worshippers imploring the intercession of saints and so on. But you don't find them falling into the trap or the situation of actually worshiping them.
Right.
And it seems to me that it goes back to the doctrine. You know, for example, in Islam is quite clear that, you know, no one should be worshipped except God. Judaism, Christianity, the same.
Yes.
You know, even though Islam might have some problems with Christianity and the humanity of Jesus and so on, I don't want to get into that. But nobody should worship anyone else but God. So you find that the saints are kept in a particular position, in a sense, almost recognizing their ontological status with respect
sure.
to God. So how far does doctrine play in controlling this type of confusion if we think that worship is the practice that is so defined that describes the exclusive relationship between the creator and the created?
Yeah, that's a complex question, but, you know, trying to make it really clear and simple. One big problem, of course, is that the traditions within the religion, the great religions, grow apart from each other. So they don't know what the other is doing. Mm-hmm. And then, let's say a visitor comes into some conversation where Miriam is being spoken about. Mm-hmm. And it seems so focused. Now, the scripture has a whole surah on Miriam, but the conversation seems so focused on Miriam, and the very, very stringent Allah-only group from which this person comes feels that this is a misplaced conversation. This is undisciplined, or by the very fact that this conversation is happening without a very quick return to the name of Allah, that it is already an error. And so you have human beings are very sensitive to cultural differences. They can live in different parts of a city, and they can pick up how different they are and decide, well, his daughter is never going to marry my son. So if human beings are making that fine a cut already, we know that cultural difference, cultural unfamiliarity, can in many cases be the complete cause. But then you have people who, where that cultural experience is coloring doctrine. We have the same doctrine. I think you're right. It protects almost all of us. There's one case where it doesn't, but you'll understand why, and that is when someone comes with a claim to be a new prophet, obviously.
Right.
And they may be monotheistic, but something is subverting authoritative doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, look at what's happening on the other end. The other side, very stringent, extremely strict, exclusivist monotheism, they have grown. Time changes everybody. And even though we have, part of the way we like to tell the story of tradition is no change. That's why we have tradition. It is changing. Mm-hmm. A new boy who becomes a cleric, just because he is a newcomer, changes it.
Right.
No matter how conformist he may make himself, he is a new person, a new soul. He will create change. Perception. And after a while, this irritation creates a new doctrinal motive. And so you have places in strict very strict exclusivist monotheist world where, let's say, an old mosque or an old church is being stripped of any other name but God. It's completely legitimate that these other names are in the calligraphy, but because they're in Quran. And even Miriam, it may get read, you know, in the recitation, but Miriam is not being talked about.
Right.
Because the other fellow Muslim seems to talk about her too much or something. Christians have this problem. Jews have this problem. It's religious alienation.
I want to thank you very much
thank
for joining
you.
Us on Minbar. I think we have just touched the tip of the iceberg. There's much more that can be said. And I'm so glad that you are in Iran from
thank
time
you.
To time. And I'm sure we'll be seeing you on Minbar to get even deeper into
grateful.
This.
I'm very grateful.
We have to take a quick news break. We will be right back. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Minbar. I'm your host, Ahmed Hanif. The Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, although they are from the same source, and although they have grown up together, so to speak, through the course of history, are now beset with internecine fighting and misunderstanding. So when we talk about unity between religions, when we talk about mutual understanding, when we talk about tolerance, as they say, we have to clean up our own home before we start cleaning up the homes of others. We have to start to solve our own pressing issues before we could solve the issues of the lack of unity and understanding between their different faiths all over the globe. So, is it practical for us to have an understanding between each other? Can we have an understanding between each other? And what is necessary for us to have that understanding? To discuss this particular issue, we are joined with Ms. Heidi Wright, researcher in comparative religion, specializing in the three divine religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Ms. Wright, welcome to Minbar.
Thank you.
So why do you think is there a lack of understanding between the Abrahamic religions?
I think part of that is just human nature. We are comfortable with what we know and what we understand, and a lot of times it's simply easier not to reach out to individuals, to just kind of stay within your own parameter, because it's scary to reach out and look out and see what other people think and believe. So I think part of this is an inner fear, and part of it is of a lack of education. So many of us were never introduced to the other religions until perhaps we pursue it on our own through college and university.
Let's talk a little bit about this fear. Huh? Let's talk a little bit about this fear. Do you think this fear is due to the fact that maybe a believing Christian, if that person starts to read about what Islam has to say, they might find themselves questioning their own particular belief, or a Muslim, for example?
I think that is part of the equation. I also think part of the equation is that in a religion like Christianity and Islam, what is so important in these two religions not only is what you do, but what you believe. So yes, if we start to question our own beliefs, that does get a little bit scary in a creedal faith, where what you take you witness and you say, I believe in this. And if you look at other religions and see something that questions what you believe in, yes, I think that's a legitimate answer to the question.
Now, we say question. When you look at Islam or Christianity, they're not so much concerned about questioning the other guy. There is that aspect of it there, but they're not a negative, they're not negative religion, so to speak. Religions based upon denying the other, for example. They are affirmative. They have something affirmative to say.
They're also based on what's called election. They're God's elected people.
Right.
So we have this in all three traditions, but particularly in Christianity and Judaism. There is this idea that their way is the only way. God sent this message to them. But we can't just focus on that, because there is a universality in it as well. So what we are saying in Islam is, yes, this is the only way, but we include within this parameter the two other traditions, the other traditions that have a revelation or a kitab, so that when you start to question these things, you learn that. For instance, when a Christian starts to question about Islam, I think they're always surprised to find out that in Islam, all of the prophets in the Abrahamic tradition, plus some of their own, are embraced and included.
So there are commonalities.
There are many
them.
Commonalities as
that
well.
That many people are not aware of.
No, they are not.
And you think that this lack of awareness could
contributes
lead
to the fear.
Uh-huh. Now, what are some of these commonalities?
It's very interesting. If I should talk about it from an Islamic perspective, as I said to you before, all of the prophets, we have Adam. I'm going to use the angelicalized names. We have
right.
Adam, we have Abraham, we have Noah, Jesus, Isaiah, Isaac,
mm-hmm.
Jacob,
right.
Jacob, both of Jacob's sons.
Right.
So this is a very surprising
commonality.
Yes, Moses.
Right.
Moses is a very big one. This is a very big surprising commonality, for instance, to Christians, because Christians think it's just about Muhammad. They think Islam is only about Muhammad. A lot of times when I talk to Christians, they think that Muhammad is the first prophet, when actually he is not. He is the final seal. The first prophet would be Abraham. And so this is something that Christians are usually surprised. Adam.
Yeah.
So most Christians are surprised to find out that not only does Islam have all these prophets, but that Jesus is the Messiah. So this is an extremely interesting concept to Christians.
Right. What other aspects of doctrine or belief do Muslims, Christians, and Jews share?
Well, we share a lot of rituals. One of the most important...
Well, don't get to the rituals here.
Okay.
What about beliefs?
Beliefs.
Like, you know, heaven, hell, ages, you know,
well,
way of judgment and so forth.
Of course, I think the greatest belief that we have is the belief in hope, in anticipation for... help from God, that the world will be judged and we will have this establishment of heaven, paradise. And this is what the conference that I recently attended is about, this hope. And I think that is the most important element in the three religions, is hope. But also there's monotheism, the idea of one God. There is the concept of a sort of judgment. There is the concept of ethical governance, of doing the right thing, if you will.
Right.
These are all commonalities in the religion.
What about cosmology, angels, demons, you know,
to a certain extent,
and so forth?
Extent, we have this. To a certain extent, there is belief in angels. It differs. It varies from degree to degree. Mm. It has different nuance and ambience in the three religions. But yes, we have the commonality of angels. We have the commonality of an individual, I won't say a divine individual, who, if it doesn't tempt us, records all of the negative that we do in
right.
the world.
An extremely powerful, malevolent force.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Now, we have these common beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
What are the differences in our understanding of these common beliefs? Like, for example, what is the difference between, let's say, the Christian concept mm-hmm. of monotheism, mm-hmm. which it adheres to, and the Muslim concept or the Jewish concept of monotheism? What's the difference in the common belief in, for example, let's say, heaven and hell?
Well, I could tell you from a Jewish perspective that heaven or hell isn't even important. Right here and right now is what is important. What you do is important. In Christianity, there is this expectation that Jesus will come in the future. So what is important there is not only the life that you live now, but the life that you will anticipate with after judgment, which is very similar to Judaism. Concepts about God, I think, for the most part, all three traditions believe that God is one and that there is no other God, that is a falsehood. The varying degrees about how they describe God or the attributes that they give to God or how God, what describes God in the best way, I think is a little bit different. For instance, in Quran, the attribute of God's mercy or compassion is always expressed more than God's wrath or judgment. And perhaps we see a lot more of judgment going on within the concept of God in Christianity. And again, as I told you, in many Jewish movements,
what do you mean by you see a lot of the concept of judgment regarding God?
Well, the main thrust in Christianity is that you will be judged for what you do.
Right.
And perhaps God is more wrathful in Christianity than he is in Islam. What I'm saying is that God, the attribute of God mentioned in Quran, the one that is most often mentioned is what?
Mercy.
Rahmani Rahim.
Right.
Okay. That is the most common attribute of God. I think in the other religions, they don't understand that about us, and they think that the God of Islam is more wrathful. But perhaps I think that wrath is more predominant in Christianity, where we have this concept of God coming, of Jesus coming, and judging the individuals, vengeance against those who have persecuted the Christians through time.
Well, some Christians would say what might take issue with that. They
yes.
might say, oh, Christian, no, Christianity is a religion of love and
it's
forgiveness.
Based on love and forgiveness.
And this is how we behave. Mm-hmm. Recently, I read a newspaper article mm-hmm. about a Kenyan, two missionaries in Kenya mm-hmm. from America, I think it was, or Canada, I can't remember, who were brutally attacked. Mm-hmm. You know, the husband left for dead, the wife beaten up and raped and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And after they found the perpetrators, mm-hmm. they forgave them. And they said, this is what our religion is all about,
mm-hmm.
that God so loved the world that he mm-hmm. sent his only begotten son, his only kid, mm-hmm. to come and die for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they say, look at Islam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do X, they cut off your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do Y, you're executed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a religion that does not have any justice, not justice, but mercy.
Islam
you know,
doesn't have mercy.
That's how many of them think.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're saying something different.
What I'm saying is that in Christianity, I think you have a concept of God being more judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Islam what we're having is a government that takes some of these and handles them right now and at hand.
Mm-hmm.
These Christians forgave what happened to them because Jesus said, turn the other cheek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone hits you, forgive them 70 times, 70 times. But I also understand that in Christianity, as in Islam, we all must face what we have done before God.
Right.
And the only way you'll be saved in Christianity is if you know and believed in Jesus and
right.
accepted him.
Right. What other differences do you see, for example, in the role of, let's say, the devil,
mm-hmm.
right? All of them have the...
In varying degrees,
yes.
Shades and ambience,
right.
We have the concept of a tempter. However, I'll say in Judaism, there really is no devil. What there is an angel that is like a prosecuting attorney.
Mm-hmm.
He tells God all that you have done wrong. Because what you have done wrong in Judaism, you have done by your own volition.
Uh-huh.
In Christianity, there is a devil who plays some part in the scenario because he tempts individuals
right.
to go astray and to do things wrong. We have this concept in Islam as well, this malevolent force, as you said, this fallen angel who, because of his pride,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't want to bow down to Adam and is angry for the status that gives him, and he says, if I have to pay for this, then I want to take as many individuals mm-hmm. with me as possible. And so we have this force that works at every angle, every chance, every turn to try to lead people astray, to lead them off of the path.
Right. Let's say the Christian view of salvation,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. That salvation is based upon accepting mm-hmm. the sacrifice of Jesus.
Yes.
Whereas the Muslim view is that salvation mm-hmm. is based upon, you know, repenting for your sins mm-hmm. and trying not to do them again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does it affect their practice, their understanding of their own particular religion?
I think in Christianity, this idea that you need to be saved by what you believe leads to a great amount of outreach. Christians want to save the world. They want other individuals to know what they call the good news, because they feel like they have been given a wonderful gift, a great opportunity, and they want to share this. This sometimes has a negative ramifications, but I believe it starts from a very genuine feeling of goodwill that they want to share this in the world. I think with Islam, the concept really is that nobody can be an intermarry between you and God. You have to go out and save yourself through repentance, but also through doing good deeds as well, doing the correct thing. So in Judaism, or I'm sorry, in Islam, I think there's an outreach as well. They want to share what they've learned. They want to share God with everybody. So I think that these concepts kind of drive the individuals to reach out to people that aren't in their religion sometimes.
Right. Now, Judaism seems to be different to both Christianity and Islam,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that Judaism doesn't make as much of an outreach.
No, they don't feel any need to.
What in Jewish doctrine has led to this type of difference between the other two?
In a Jewish doctrine, God establishes a covenant with the Jewish people.
Alone.
Alone.
Right.
But God has covenants with other people. So that in Judaism, it's perfectly fine for a Jew to be a Jew. It's perfectly fine for a Christian to be a Christian, because God has a separate covenant with the Christians. He also has a separate covenant with the Muslims. So there isn't any need for a Jew to reach out to bring people into the religion. The only sense that they would reach out would be reach out to the community, but they're not trying to draw individuals in. That's
mm-hmm.
that's not even done.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, if an individual wants to convert to Judaism, they have to make the effort, and they have to go out of their way to do this, because a lot of times the Jews will not respond to that until they understand that it's sincere, that
mm-hmm.
they really want to be Jewish.
Does Judaism actually see God making covenants with other people?
Yes, there
mm-hmm.
are. The Jews believe they have their own covenant with God, and they believe that other nations have a covenant with God as well.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how important do you think it is? I mean, you know, we can talk about the commonalities,
mm-hmm.
Which is fine,
mm-hmm.
but is knowing the differences between them, is that also important
mm-hmm.
in creating some kind of mutual understanding between each other?
I think it's paramount. I think it's very important. I think approaching other religions, you have to start, you have to build your foundation on common ground. It has to be strong, but I believe that we have to be able to criticize each other, but we have to be able to do it with respect. I think that it's okay for them there to be differences among the other religions, but I don't think it's okay for us not to respect them or to approach it with a negative attitude. If we can start with a very common idea, for instance, let's just say we all believe in the same God.
Mm-hmm.
If we can start from there, then I think we are able to accept the differences much easier than if we don't have anywhere to start from.
Right.
Because if you and I don't agree on something, you're going to continue to argue, you're going to start the argument from your own perspective, and you're not going to really listen to what I have to say.
Right.
But if we start from somewhere where we say, okay, we're going to agree to disagree, and we're going to start from a common ground, and we're going to build from there.
Right.
You know, we can have a room over here that, for instance, we'll call this Judaism. And we can have this room over here, and it's quite all right. It's not going to affect the building if we have a strong foundation. If we didn't have a strong foundation, it won't stick.
Right, right. What are some of the forces that militate against that understanding?
Again, as I said before, some of that force are some of the inherent beliefs in the religions themselves. But I believe that these are a test for us. This is a something that God wants us to try to look at and overcome and continue to go forth. Because the Quran says, if I wanted you to all be the same, I would have made you all the same. But go out and compete with each other and try to understand each other. So if we were supposed to all do the same thing, we would all be doing the same thing. But this is an opportunity to learn more, not only about others, but about ourselves.
Right.
You know, to learn and to grow a little bit yourself. Because if you stay just within your own small parameter, how is that growing? How is that expanding? How is that learning anything?
Mm-hmm. So how do you think these differences came about? You know, these differences in approach, if you can say, or understanding of these fundamental common concepts and beliefs. How do you think this growth of the differences came about?
I believe some of it is inherent in human nature. And then I believe some of it is cultural. The reason that some cultures have the religion that they have has to do with the way they are where they are, if you understand what I'm saying. So it's very difficult, for instance, for Islam to have developed in a metropolitan area where Christianity developed. So I think some of this has to do with the cultural location where the religion oriented. I mean, it worked for them because it addressed some of their very basic needs.
I see. So
so it's natural.
Right.
I think it's natural. I think it's divine.
For them to have differences in approach.
Yes.
Based upon time and space.
And human nature.
Right.
I mean, we all don't think the same way for a reason.
Today, in this world we're living in right now, what are some of the obstacles that exist that are preventing people from pursuing an understanding of each other? You know, governments, the media.
I agree. I think that right now it's very difficult to find a positive representation of Islam, for instance, in the Western media. It's very difficult. There's an agenda right now, and sometimes some aspects of Islam that gets the spotlight are the radical or the fundamental aspects. There are billions of Muslims in the world, you know, they don't all think the same way. They don't all believe in the same thing. So I think part of it is that it doesn't receive fair treatment in the press. This is one of the factors.
Right. So what other obstacles do you see in our contemporary society today that prevent us from even thinking about seeking some kind of mutual understanding?
Well, I definitely think some of them are individual, and as I said before, some of it is related to the media. But I believe as we progress as individuals and society, we're going to be able to overcome some of these obstacles. But as individuals, we have to be prepared to challenge some of our own beliefs and to reach out and to look and see what other religions talk about, and to be prepared to apply that within our own religion and say, you know, maybe there's a reason that there are these commonalities. You know, maybe there has to be a reason why this is like that. You understand what
I'm
saying?
Right.
Even if you are investigating that and you find the answer yourself, you have broadened your horizon. You have learned something. You have learned some new words, some new concepts about another religion. So that even if that is the only outcome, that you learn something new, isn't that wonderful?
Right.
Isn't that fantastic that you know, I'm 44 years old. If I go out and look something up, I think it's wonderful that at my age I'm continuing to learn. And you know, we learn until the day we die, and we die when we have learned all that we need to learn.
As they say, a long journey begins with a first step.
Yep.
I want to thank you very much, Heidi, for joining us. It was very, very insightful and interesting, and I hope to have you again some other time on Minbar.
Inshallah, it was my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. And remember, if you have any questions, comments, or criticisms, please don't forget to write us at minbar@presstv.ir. That's minbar@presstv.ir. On behalf of myself, the staff, and Heidi, I want to thank you all for joining us. And see you again next week, same time, same place on Minbar.